The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for June 10th, 2017. I think you're going to find out that this week's show is very interesting and a bit different from what we usually offer up for your listening enjoyment. I was a terrible chemistry student. I wasn't bad at math, calculus, algebra. I even liked physics, but chemistry was not my forte. Had I known my first guest all those years ago when I flailed around in the chem lab, my life might have taken a different tack, though. Professor Casey Raymond is a chemistry whiz. In fact, just this week he won an award from the school where he teaches, which is SUNY Oswego in upstate New York. The 2017 SUNY Oswego President's Award for Teaching Excellence will honor chemistry faculty member Dr. Casey Raymond, who garnered praise in more than a dozen letters of support from colleagues and alumni for his 14 years of challenging, supporting, and inspiring his students. The article is long and glowing, and if you'd like to read it, you can find it at oswego.edu. So what is it that makes Casey so popular? Besides his enthusiasm for his subject and his gentle but persistent encouragement for his students, he takes a group to Europe for a beer, whiskey, and cheese study course. And because one piece of his curriculum is fermentation and food science, he has become a master brewer and gourmand. What does this have to do with bicycles? Well, there's bicycles and beer. They go together. And in his studies in Europe, he also incorporates history, social norms, and transportation. You see, we did get there. I think you'll enjoy our conversation. Then we're going to speak with Action Hagen's Berman rider Johnny Brown. He's been the U.S. National Amateur Road Race champ twice, just had a great showing at the Corsicana three-day stage race in Texas, he's from Austin, and won the Hotter Than Hell 100 last year. Johnny also has some lofty and engaging ideas for his post-race days, so he's thinking way ahead. We'll take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk with Matt Holden from Oat Root. When we think of the word oat, it is usually paired with couture. The dictionary definition is fashionable and high class. So it is this week that we speak with Matt about Oat Root as it pertains to cycling. The Oat Root is cycling's first global series of multi-day cyclosportifs for amateurs. This year, the first U.S. version of these events is in the Colorado Rockies. You could also ride the French Alps, the Pyrenees, or the Italian Dolomites and more. They're fully supported events, they're 7 days long, and they're timed. But I'll let Matt tell you all about them. So let's take a trip up to Oswego, New York to catch up with Professor Casey Raymond and learn about beer, whiskey, cheese, and more. Hi, Casey. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. How's my favorite chemistry professor today?
I'm doing good, Dan.
Well, it's good to talk with you. I haven't seen you in almost a year.
Yep.
I know. It'll be a year in a couple of weeks.
Yes, it will.
We should probably preface our conversation by saying that we're good friends. and have known each other almost 20 years, and I still don't know exactly what you do.
Well, the simple story is I teach, but I teach university chemistry.
Okay. I think it's a little more complicated than that, but we'll go. We'll go. You know, because most people will cringe and say, oh, my goodness, like me, I was not a good chemistry student.
And I get that response a lot. But at the same time, I look at them and say, well, I wasn't really a great student in English either. But we all have our strengths. We have our weaknesses. And I've really kind of pushed chemistry to non-science majors. I teach a lot of science majors, but I've taught 21, 22 different classes while I've been here at SUNY Oswego, and some of them are for non-science majors. And really, they need to know some of the science as well. They don't need to know all the details, but the chemistry really affects them, and that's how I basically spun a hobby into the course that we'll talk about a little bit today related to fermentation science and food science.
Well, certainly your students love you, and the other faculty. You got an amazing award this past, we are talking on Thursday. This award was announced yesterday, I think, yes?
Yes.
Go ahead and tell us what the award is.
It's a campus-wide award from our president and search committee or selection committee for outstanding excellence in teaching.
Which obviously that is you, because reading some of the accolades from some of your past students and some of the faculty, it's really interesting how you've engaged these people in what we're going to talk about today, especially. But in just chemistry, when you think, oh, chemistry, it's such a scary subject. It was for me. Anyway, you are creative, and that's what most people don't know, I think, if they think about just science, you know, that chemists are not necessarily creative, but you have an amazing amount of creativity in what you've done. And, of course, your wife, Melissa, has had a little bit of influence because of the cooking, I think, yes?
Yeah, although it was interesting when we first met, I cooked as well, but we cooked very differently in very different styles, and we learned from each other.
Hmm. Well, I've had dinner with you, and it's usually pretty dang good, I must say. So let's talk a little bit about beer and whiskey and cheese.
Yep. So where do you want me to start?
Well, you gave a presentation titled A University Course on Fermentation Science in a Global Society with a Study Abroad Flavor. Now, if you break that down into its pieces parts, you're going to figure out that you take a group of students to Europe, and you do some really cool things with them. But let's talk a little bit about the association first, what that lecture covered and how it related to your teaching.
Yep. So that presentation was at the World Brewing Congress in 2012, actually. And the World Brewing Congress happens in the United States once every 4 years. So it's not a frequent meeting, frequent event, and it's sponsored by a whole multitude of organizations from within the United States and North America, Japan, a couple of organizations in Europe. I happen to be a member of the American Society of Brewing Chemists, which is one of the organizing bodies for this. And there's a lot of really technical, detailed discussions at that meeting. There's workshops. One of them I attended was actually tasting and smelling some new hop varieties to give different flavors to beer that aren't even available to brewers yet. They're just being developed and cloned and through hybrid farming, basically. And I went out to present this course that we've developed, a colleague and I here in the chemistry department, have developed over the last 11 years involving students in fermentation science and how that relates to the world around them here in upstate New York, but even more importantly, getting them a sense of a study abroad experience. And we can definitely talk about that in a little bit as far as what that study abroad component is. But the presentation really focused on how we developed the course, the types of things that we cover, both here in the classroom as well as abroad. And it was meant to give other people the idea, the tools to do it themselves. We don't want to necessarily be unique in doing it.
Are you saying that the people to whom you gave this presentation took some of that into their own either academic environment or even home environment or whatever it is, laboratories, and are beginning to use your ideas to teach in other areas?
I think I would say it's much more the idea of being able to take the content, the chemistry, the science, the basic information, and how it is related to fermentation, be it beer, cheese, wine, bread, and so forth, and get presented in a broader context, as well as how you can really think outside the box and extend what comes down to is a science class into a study abroad experience.
Okay, and we will talk about that. But it just occurred to me that one of the things I think most of us know, but we know it in a strange kind of way, is beer is really old. It's been around since like dirt.
Yep.
And so what is it about beer specifically? I mean, I do want to know about the whiskey, and I do want to know about the cheese, and I do want to know, of course, about this experience that you take these students to, because transportation is part of it, and that's our little tie-in to bicycles, even though it might be small, because the beer and wine are way, or the beer and whiskey are way more interesting. What has changed over the years so much that you've been able to develop such a broad course about it?
So beer is incredibly old. It was really probably originally made completely by accident, and a lot of the early technology, for lack of a better term, of beer was trial and error. And it wasn't until Louis Pasteur figured out a little bit of what fermentation was, and a bunch of other chemists and biologists argued for 30 years over what yeast was and what it wasn't, that the science really started to get defined. But the idea of using beer in this vehicle, at least in the United States, really became viable with the explosion of microbreweries in the 1980s and in the late 1970s, in effect, legalization of home brewing within the United States. People started doing these things legally. They were doing it before regardless. And that meant we have a much better ingredients available, a much larger variety of ingredients available, which means you can make pretty much anything you could possibly imagine in terms of a beer today. And because of that, and you have all these craft brewing explosion, and it just made it viable to use beer to teach some basic science.
Well, it certainly is interesting. At least I think the students think it's interesting.
Yeah, they certainly do.
I'm signing up for that course, the one that's got the beer. So let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dr. Casey Raymond. He's in Oswego, New York, at SUNY Oswego. And we're talking about beer and whiskey and cheese. And eventually we might even mention bicycles once in a while. So let's talk a little bit about what beer and whiskey and cheese and all these things say about society and what you do then with these students as you take them abroad. And when you do go abroad, when do you go?
We teach our course the second half of our spring semester, and so then we go abroad in the middle to end of May. And we only go for 8 to 10 days. Part of that is just to keep the pricing manageable for the students and just to keep the whole thing manageable. This idea of the short study abroad course started on our campus to give our students a chance to experience a different culture without having to commit to a whole semester abroad and maybe delay graduation or just have all the other issues, or the idea of going somewhere for a whole semester that you don't know anything about is a little intimidating. And so our campus started some of these courses that were related to art or specific cities or specific locations, And, you know, they were looking for more, and the call went out. Hey, are there any of these other courses that we could do this with? And at the time, my colleague was at a meeting and said, hey, we could teach a class on whiskey and do Scottish literature and go to Scotland. And, of course, everybody in the room laughed.
I'll bet they did. Yeah, they're not laughing now.
No, it was a year later that we finally did propose doing it on a class on fermentation in general and to take students abroad. And the first group went in 2006. And so we talk about the basic ideas of fermentation each year. If we're going to Scotland, we talk a little bit more about distilling and whiskey and how that ties in. But we adjust the course depending on what country we go to. So, as I said, we've done Scotland. We've been to Belgium several times. We just got back from 9 days in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. We've taken a group to Munich, Germany, a group to the Czech Republic. And so we kind of tailor what we're doing in the course as far as examples to where we're going. And it is to really demonstrate, besides giving the experience in Europe, how differently these fermented products are treated in different locations. And I think the biggest experience that our students have is that the appreciation of especially beer or whiskey or wine in all of these other countries that they're in is very different and very good model of appropriate behavior compared to what they might see here in the college environment on the weekend.
You mean like crazy parties?
Exactly.
Well, so what kinds of things are they seeing that then they bring back and say, well, wait a minute, maybe can I incorporate some of this into the way I live my life now and not be so insane, perhaps?
We've had students pretty quickly go, and we had a student meet some other university students in one of the countries we were in, and the next day he commented to us that they don't know any drinking games. And that things like that where it's you can sit down with a group of friends and have a beer or a glass of wine or a drink with dinner or just, you know, out at a pub having a couple beers, being very social. It's all in moderation. Sure, there are people that still drink to excess here and there, but they all of a sudden witness that that's not what most of the rest of the world does with alcohol.
How interesting.
And one of the things, because most of the countries we go to, the drinking age is 18, we don't have any age limit on any of our study abroad classes. And we don't require them in this country or in any country to consume alcohol if they don't want to. But all of a sudden, students that are under 21 are in a country in an environment that they can legally buy alcohol. And what we've found is, in not every case, but many cases, the first 36 hours or so that we're in that country, the students are really wanting to buy a beer or a drink every opportunity they possibly have. And after 36 hours, all of a sudden, it's no big deal. Yeah, they'll sit down and have a beer with dinner or lunch or with friends, but it's just the mystique of drinking is completely gone, and it's just a normal everyday event.
Wow, I think that's awesome. How does transportation figure into your course, along with history and some of the other things that you teach? I mean, obviously, it is about fermentation and food science, but there are other things that you sort of incorporate.
Well, we certainly do, and one of the things that we decided to do early on and continue to this day is to do as much of the transportation within the country we can on what's publicly available. So it's a really rare situation that we charter a bus or a special transportation to do something. We do a lot of walking where we are. In one case in Belgium, we generally We'll take a train out to a small community and then do what works out to be about a 4-kilometer walk out to one of the abbeys that brews beer. Beer's pretty much only available there, and they have a cafe. And so we sit and have a beer and lunch with the students and then walk back to the train station to take the train back to where our hotel is. We do stuff on local buses, local trams, just to really give the students a sense of what a robust public transportation system is like. And most of them are thoroughly amazed at how readily available it is, how clean it is, how easy it is to use. And we make the students keep a journal the entire time that they're in Europe and give them half a dozen or so specific writing assignments. And one of them is almost always, you know, discuss your perception of the transportation system. And sometimes it includes bikes. We rarely can take and get all 12, 14 students on bikes to go and do something. But sometimes biking is available to them.
Would you say that the students come back with a different sense of not just beer and wine and cheese and all of those things that are pertinent to your class, but to a sense of change in the way they think about transportation and the way they think about drinking and the way they just live their lives? Do they actually make changes in their lives, do you think?
Some of them certainly do. And we've certainly seen it from, you know, students that took the course several years ago with us. I know many students have expressed the desire of, why don't we have train service like this, or why don't we have more public transit like this? And we're always kind of careful with them to make them stop and think about the scale. What are the distances? It's like when we're in Belgium, we do a lot just on trains to go between different cities to do different activities, whether it's to visit a World War I battlefield and World War I museum, or if it's to visit a specific brewery. And it's very easy to hop on a train, go 40 minutes, and hop off. But all of those locations are relatively close. It's a little different scale situation if we tried to do that kind of rail across the entire United States. But I think regionally, there are some things that could very easily be done kind of on a state-by-state or small region area that would mimic that transportation system.
Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Casey Raymond. He's a professor of chemistry at SUNY Oswego. And I want to bring it back to the U.S. for a second now. Many of your students have gone on to do some very great things, both, you know, nationally, internationally. But let's talk about a little bit about what listeners might do. I know a lot of people try home brewing. They try to make their own beer, their own wine, other spirits. Do you have some advice that you might give someone that they might not be able to learn just by going to one of these places that's, you know, like make your own beer and everything's pretty much the same? What would you give them as advice to start out with?
I think probably the most important piece of advice is meet and talk with people that are already doing it. I first kind of participated in home brewing in 1993 with a fellow graduate student that had been brewing his own beer for years. And then when I moved to Ohio nearly 20 years ago, it was, okay, I'm going to start and do it myself. And I got involved with a homebrew club in the Akron area, Saz. I know there's also the one in Northeast Ohio. There's multiple homebrew clubs all over the country now. And so really find a homebrew club and go to one of their meetings and talk with them. We just passed the first weekend in May, about a month ago, and that was the American Homebrewers Association's Big Brew Day, and people all over the world were brewing on that first Saturday in May. Coming up in early November will be Teach Someone to Homebrew Day, and so clubs will open up and have homebrewing lessons on that day. So We can post, I'm sure you can post the link, but American Home Brewers Association has a whole list, state by state, of where clubs are, as well as where you can get extra information, where you can find homebrew supply stores. Many of those homebrew supply stores will have a wealth of knowledge. Homebrewing can be as easy as heating some water to a boil, adding some syrup, and then cooling it down, adding some yeast, and letting it ferment for a week and put it in the bottle, to as complicated and as expensive as you want it to be, just like any other hobby.
Do you have a favorite beer these days, Casey?
It's hard to say that I have an absolute favorite, but certainly one of the top go-to beers are the Belgian sour beers. And I'll put that out there just as a general style. There are different versions of sour beers, but I very much like sour beers, and it's type of beer, a style of beer, that if you've never had them, the first couple times you've had them, you might not really know what to think, and it's very possible the first taste you have, you'll want to spit it out.
Yeah, probably because
it's a very strange thing. You're expecting a beer, and it's not. They tend to almost sometimes be more wine-like, but they are distinctly sour.
Well, I know that you like strong flavor or distinct flavor, as does Brian. I'm a little, you know, more moderate in those ideas. Have you ever done any wine brewing? Wine fermenting.
I haven't, and it's something we talk about a little bit in the class. In some respects, winemaking isn't easy, but the one thing about making wine or making cider, hard cider that is, all you have to do is take the juice that already has the sugar present. Add your yeast, let it ferment, and you're good. Whereas making beer or whiskey or some of these other spirits where you start with grain, there's a whole range of extra steps that you have to do just to get to the point of having that sugary syrup, that sugary water, but then you can ferment the way you would apple juice and cider and grape juice and wine. Kind of backtracking a little bit, I just want to make sure everybody kind of understands that doing your own distilling, if you want to make your own whiskey, isn't legal. People still do it.
Yeah, but we call them bootleggers.
What's interesting is New Zealand tried banning distilling for many, many years, and they realized it was costing them more to enforce it than they were making from their fees or fines for doing it. So they just legalized home distilling.
Interesting. Well, we're a little behind the times in some areas here, that being one of them. Well, this is, as I thought it would be, very interesting, fascinating. We will post the Homebrewers Association link to our Facebook page. And if anybody's interested in knowing more about Casey and his work, it is at SUNY Oswego's website, and you can look him up on the faculty, Dr. Casey Raymond. Hey, Casey, say hello to Melissa, and thanks so much for talking with me today. This was fun. I knew it would be.
My pleasure.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Professor Casey Raymond joined me from his office at SUNY Oswego. Casey's also a Scrabble whiz. He loves ice hockey. He rides a Waterford single, and he and his wife, Melissa, ride a lovely commotion tandem. You can find out more about homebrewing at the homebrewersassociation.org. We're going to take a short break for our station to identify itself and come back to speak with Action Hagen's Berman rider, Johnny Brown. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
U.S. National Crit Championships are going to be in Kentucky in a few weeks, and Action Hagen's Berman Johnny Brown will be there with the team. Let me introduce you to him. Hi, Johnny. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it is my pleasure. And I want to take a moment to convey my condolences to you and the entire Action Hagen's Berman team for your losses this year. Chad Young and Sean Whitey, been a tough year for all of you. I'm very sorry.
Yeah, thank you very much. It has been a rough last few weeks.
It has. And Sean and I were pretty good friends. So I didn't really know Chad, but, you know, it's just been really hard on all of us. So I hope we can move on and remember them for the just wonderful people that they were. And they'll keep, like, you know, pushing us on in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
Let's begin with your cycling background and your history. Where did you grow up? When did you decide that bike racing was the path you wanted to pursue?
I grew up in Tennessee. I grew up in a small town called Covington, so it's like 50 miles north of Memphis. And then I've been around cycling pretty much my whole life, actually. So my dad raced professionally back in the 80s, and then my older brother, that's 6 years older than me, got into it when he was about 10. So that would, I was about 4 at the time. So then, yeah, I mean, I started racing when I was 10 years old, and then, yeah, I haven't looked back since.
Well, what's really interesting is you have zero accent for growing up in Tennessee and living in Texas.
Yeah. Well, my mom is from Chicago. My dad actually grew up in Costa Rica, so we're not native to Tennessee, but.
Okay. Well, I just thought I'd mention that, you know, because.
Yeah.
Of course, that's what you get for having expectations, right?
Yeah.
What do you think it takes to become a member of a team like Action?
It's kind of a combination of things. I mean, I don't think it's all about just being the best cyclist. It's more of you're excellent rider, and then but you also need to have, I think, a really good personality off the bike as well, and just mend with the staff and your teammates and just, yeah, everyone that you'll come involved with being with the team. Yeah, so it's that combination of everything.
So it's interesting because you actually race for a really interesting guy. You know, Axel Merckx has such a rich history in cycling, with probably the most famous father on the planet when it comes to bicycles. Is he a great team manager?
Yeah, he is excellent. The best, I think, in the business.
Yeah. So you've already been a national champion, and 2017 nationals are just around the corner. What are your goals for this year's events?
This is my first pro national, so it's hard, and I'm only 20 years old, so I'm racing people with years of experience, so it's hard to have a set goal, I think. I think the biggest thing for me this year is just learning and gaining experience, and then just seeing where everything falls in the race. Going in this year, I don't have many expectations, but just to have fun and learn.
So what will you be riding? Which events this year?
I'll do the time trial and the road race.
Wow. And then are you going to do the crit in Louisville?
No crit for me. No, just the time trial road race.
Where do you think your specialty is going to end up as you begin moving up the ranks? Do you have any, like, goals for being a specialist in, you know, like, stage race or time trial? Or what is it that really interests you?
I think my biggest thing is I'm better at one-day races. Yeah, just the long, hard one-days, and even classics and races like that are what really interest me. So that's, I think the more I grow in my professional career, that's the more I'll start towards leaning to and really focusing on those type of events.
If that's the case, what do you think the one event, if you could win one event in your career, what is it that you would want to win? Which one? Which one, Lee?
Paris-Roubaix.
Of course. That's a good one.
No, I think I did the junior version both years when I was 17 and 18. And even though it was the most brutal race I've ever done in my life, I had so much fun. And, yeah, I just love it.
So you like the cobbles and you like all that crazy stuff.
Yeah. No, it's just really hectic. And it's not only race and nutrition, it's luck and, just, yeah, everything combined.
Oh, You mentioned nutrition. Well, I'll have questions toward the end that I'll ask you. So, you know, I want to remind our listeners, first of all, we're speaking with Johnny Brown. He is a 20-year-old rider for Action Hagens Berman, one of the, I think, premier feeder teams in the network of teams. You already seem to know what you want to do after you're done racing, which is really weird. I mean, other than people like Eric Heiden, who knew what he wanted to become a doctor. Tell us about your aspirations to start a junior team.
Yes, yeah, so I was really fortunate as a junior as well, and I was part of this team called Hot Tubes. So it's Action is the biggest U23 team, and this would be the biggest junior team. And being involved in a team like that gave me so many opportunities and lessons as a young, like 16, 17-year-old and 18, that I kind of want to do that for young kids that age as well once I am done racing professionally. And I don't think you never can have enough junior teams because they are the future of the sport.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. So do you think you would want to have men's and women's teams?
Yes, because, I mean, yeah, I would definitely like to have both because cycling is not just a sport for men. It is also for women. And I think men have dominated the sport for so long that we need to start making our shift and developing young women cyclists as well. And there's not one junior girls women's team in the U.S. So I think that is something that's huge as well.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear you say that. So do you think there should be or could be more diversity in cycling?
What do you mean by that question?
Well, okay, so I'm going to be politically incorrect and say cycling is a white man's sport.
Yeah.
While that's sort of true, I mean, we do have people like Nairo Quintana and we do have the African riders in Rwanda and they're sort of sparsely interspersed with professionals. When you look at the peloton, it is basically white. And that's men and women.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess my question goes right back to what I said. Do you think there could be more diversity in our sport?
Totally. That's the thing I think. Yeah. It's almost like if you went back, yeah, you just don't see it much at all. But I will say even in the last like 3 years, I just came back from Europe even. I've seen there was more than normal and I think it's something that's huge and it needs to be much more than there is, way more than there is actually.
One of the things that seems to hold other riders back is because it's not a cheap sport. You wonder how you can begin to finance in a way that would allow, it's like golf, you know, golf didn't become a really integrated sport until Tiger Woods became the preeminent golfer. So maybe we need a star like that. I don't know. It's just an idea. But at any rate, I would love to see more diversity.
No, I totally agree.
Good. Because then maybe you'll do that, right?
Yeah, no, of course.
Yeah. So you said, and I'm going to quote you, you really like being around younger kids and sharing your knowledge of cycling with them while giving them life experiences that many teens never learn. What are some of those life experiences?
So the junior team I was talking about earlier, Hot Tubes, in this team, it was just six of us. So we traveled around the world to do races anywhere from Ireland to France to Canada. And not only, I mean, we're only 17 years old, so it's like, even though we have our director there with us, he taught us even small things, like many of us didn't even know how to do our own dishes or cook or anything. I mean, you see it a lot even at the national team all the time. That's like a 19-year-old kid literally won't even know how to clean his own dish. So I think it's, just life experiences and just learning how to be a young adult and learning it's pretty much how to grow up.
Wow. Just grow up. I got it.
Yeah.
That's great. So if someone listening to the show wanted to pursue a cycling career, a youngster, somebody, let's say 14, 15, just getting out and just loves to race his or her bike, what kind of advice would you begin to give somebody like that?
I think cycling is a very tough and brutal sport. But at the same time, I think you just have to have perseverance and you just can never stop, and you always just have to keep pushing forward no matter what cycling or life throws at you, because it is, yeah, the most beautiful sport you can do. And just the freedom of being out there and riding and racing, you just have to keep pushing through, I think, no matter what cycling throws at you.
Okay, well, I have three questions I always ask everybody, and you don't escape them. What's your favorite food?
I would say Mexican.
You are not alone in that one. I would say 30 to 40% of the people I ask say that. That's really great. Our sport, right? Exactly. What kind of music do you like? Now, you're 20, so you're going to have something a little different, maybe.
I like outlaw country, like old outlaw country music.
Wow, there's a category I didn't know existed. And do you have any pets?
Yeah, I have a little dog and then a cat as well.
Well, you just won my heart. That is so cool. Well, Johnny, thank you so much for talking with me. Good luck at the Nationals. We'll keep watching your career and keep the rubber side down.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Oh, it is my pleasure. Have a good one.
You as well.
Okay, bye-bye. Johnny Brown, Action Hagens Berman's team rider. Join me from his home. We'll be watching the Nationals and see what transpires. We're going to take another short break, and when we return, Matt Holden will join me to talk about oat root. You may just want to sign up for one. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back, and we're heading to the UK to talk with Matt Holden about oat route, luxury coupled with tough climbs. Hi, Matt. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So, and I hope I get the pronunciation of this right. My French isn't as good as it used to be. I saw the first posting for, is it oat routes?
Yeah, very good.
Thanks.
The Americans normally say out route, like nearly the complete opposite. But yeah, in French it's oat route.
That's what I thought. And it looks like an amazing event for anybody who wants to sort of replicate what goes on in the continental races. Tell us what the name oat route means and how it applies to the events we'll be talking about today.
Yeah, so it's quite simple, really. Oat route means the high road. So all our events so far are around mountains. So either you're going up or you're going down, but the aim is to take the high road. Well, I guess the origination was around a ski mountaineering event in Europe that runs between Chamonix in France and Zermatt in Switzerland, and the road between the two places across, can either hike it or in the summer you can ski trek it, was called the high road. So we took a similar kind of concept and adapted that to cycling.
Oat route is a production of OC Sports, and I noticed they're really into sailing. Who in the organization decided, ooh, cycling is just as good or maybe better?
Good question. So we've been going about 20 years. Sailing was a big sort of driver. The original founder was a professional sailor in his own right, and then managed some sort of sailing campaigns and events. Then we got speaking to a French company who were very interested in taking this new kind of multi-day cycling concept for amateurs forward. And our chairman at the time had really got into the amateur cycling side of things. So it seemed like a real perfect fit. A good group of guys in France with a really great concept, but needed a little bit of backing and some support and some risk to be able to make it happen. So we took that risk, merged with those guys in 2010, and here we are now in 2017.
So I'm wondering why I hadn't heard of it until now. That's kind of weird.
Yeah, I think in Europe now we are much more well-known than we had been in the past. So it was a relatively alien concept, I guess, in 2011 and then even into 2013 or 14, really. We've not done a lot of marketing previously in the US, and we'll talk about it a little bit later, but it's one of our key areas. So I think people who have raced their bike a lot maybe and were looking specifically to try and find kind of challenge, found it through somebody else who'd done it or word of mouth. But we hadn't publicized that heavily generally up until about 2014, and then specifically now up into the US.
Explain what the concept is.
Sure. So the ones that we've got, the original Oak Roots, should I call them, are a 7-day point-to-point, moving each day, 7-stage amateur timed ranked challenge. So we have you have different concepts over there in the US. So we call what you would call a Grand Fondo, we call a Cyclosportive, basically a similar kind of concept. But if I was to boil it down, it would be similar to a 7-day Grand Fondo, but a timed and ranked Grand Fondo with all the sort of appropriate permissions, moving from point to point, but with everything that you would need to be riding like a pro. So everything from your feed stations to Mavic neutral support vehicles within the race, medical team looking after you, doctors on hand, feed stations, and then after the event, nice lunch, massage, physiotherapy if you need it, an evening briefing, and then over to a nice hotel to spend the night. So the concept really is the multi-day challenge, but supported as much as you can. So you just need to turn up and ride your bike.
So how many people are typically signing up for one of the events?
We have a cap, normally around between 500 and 550, which is mainly partially due to accommodation. So the events that we've run in Europe are generally in relatively small ski towns. We normally start in a large location like Venice or Geneva or Nice, where accommodation is no problem at all. But some of these smaller ski resorts, if you want to move from a point-to-point venue, we have, let's say 500. We've gone up to even 600 a couple of times, but then 150 staff on top of that. So there's an accommodation side of things. There's partly a logistical side of things, because we move everybody's bags from point to point every day, and we move our race village from point to point every day. So more people, more bags, more hassle, I guess, compared to something like a big Tour de France or Giro d'Italia, where the professionals are looked after by their own teams. So Team Sky or Team BMC have the riders, and then they're looked after separately. The press and media are looked after separately, whereas we're more like a big travelling circus, I guess, where we have 400, 500, 600 riders maximum, plus 150 staff to look after each day.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Matt Holden. He's over in London, in a rainy London, which is sort of redundant. And we're talking about the events called Oat Roots. This year, the first event is in the U.S., the Mavic Oat Root Rockies. Let's talk about that one and when it's going to happen and how many days it is and that kind of thing, and where it might be heading. Have you been over here to sort of scout out the route?
Certainly have. I've been over 6 or 7 times maybe. We first came back in, I think, early 2015. We have partnered with Mavic, who some of you don't know that much on the cycling side, have been heavy in the sort of development of cycling, and they provide a lot of the neutral support. So you see their yellow cars in a lot of the big pro bike races, and Tour de France in particular. We've been looking to expand, so we've been previously in France, in Italy, in Spain, in Switzerland, in Austria, and we started to think about making the move over to the US. We have a lot of North American riders, probably about 15 to 20% of our riders come over from North America to Europe to come and ride our events. We spoke a little bit with Mavic and a lot of our other sort of sponsors and influencers, and said, where should we go next? We'd like to come to the US. They said, well, the Rocky Mountains, Colorado's got to be pretty high on your hit list. So we went out, had a look around, started speaking to various events and various other parties, host cities, local governments and communities, and trying to figure out how best we could do it. Because I think we're quite knowledgeable in Europe. I can tell you how most things happen politically, legally, on the road, you know, what the culture is around cycling. But we didn't have that in the US. So we came over on a few site visits. We did a little test event a year out from the event, and we started to hire some local staff. So we hired a guy called Chandler Smith, who previously ran a very, very big event in Colorado. It's more a tour, but called Ride the Rockies. So a seven-day event, which has been running 30 years in Colorado. So we tried to get the right kind of people on board, and as we found, the landscape is a little bit different, both from an admin, legal, and political side, and from a mountain standpoint. So it's been a good, interesting challenge, I should say, to put it together.
And when will it occur?
So it's June 24th.
Oh, it's coming up
this
quick.
Year. Coming up soon, so a couple of months' time. I think you guys are just out of, most regions, out of the back end of ski season and just into that shoulder season now. So we start the first stage in Boulder, Saturday, June the 24th, and then we run a stage around Boulder on the 24th. And then pretty much we make our way across the Front Range. We go to Winter Park, we go to Avon. We do a time trial in Avon. It's another of our sort of themes. We normally try and have six stages, one of which being a queen stage or the largest stage, and one of which being an individual time trial. So we run a time trial around Avon. Then we move from Avon to Snowmass, and from Snowmass to Crested Butte. And then we make a transfer by coach, and we do a finishing circuit around Colorado Springs. So we've got six interesting and different cities to bring on board, from a large city like Colorado Springs to some ski towns, you know, Snowmass Village, to Avon, and then to, you know, sort of a bike mecca in the Boulder.
Right. Well, lots of stuff in Boulder. Boulder's an interesting town.
Exactly right.
So the structure of the event, I know it's timed. Is there an overall winner and then category winners? I mean, obviously, we're competing for something here, right?
Yeah, that's right. So trying to think how I would liken it. Probably something similar to like an Ironman. So you have your categories. You can be in the, you know, the male 35 to 45 category, or you can be in the female 45 to 55 category. Some people ride for their position. You know, there's a few people at the front, and it becomes very clear very quickly that there's only a few people who are going to be challenging to actually make a podium and win. Then you have a much larger group. Some are very competitive. They're very happy to be 49th or 99th or 199th, and they compete against themselves and against their peer group. And then we have quite a large contingent, as per, I would guess, an Ironman event, who it's a big challenge and something to complete rather than to compete. So the competition is more with yourself to get yourself to the finish line, get up again each day and do the same thing. So I guess there's different categories of riders in terms of competition and podium finishes. And then there's a lot of riders who are there to enjoy themselves, have a good time riding the bike, get supported and get from point to point each day.
It sounds like such an interesting concept. I like the whole idea. There's a brand new event called Haute Route Ventoux. It's different from the others. When is it, and explain the difference between that and your regular Haute Route events?
We started to look at the concept a little bit, and I guess, again, if I come back slightly to an Ironman feel of concept, the challenge that we have is pretty big. It's 7 days, so it requires quite a lot of time off work, probably quite a lot of time away from your family, quite a lot of time to train. It's, I would say, a value event to do, but it's got a price tag that comes with it in terms of your flight, your accommodation, and your race entry. So we looked at this and thought, yeah, that really works for some people, but could we create something that actually had the same kind of ethos? So around the mountains, around the professionalism and support and the permissions and the safety side of things, and all the sort of off-the-bike support that you get in one location, so you don't need to move your bag each night, you don't need to find a new hotel, in one city. So we've looked at that around the mountain Ventoux, and we've also looked at it around Alpe d'Huez, in the centre of France as well, in the Alps. And we'll continue to roll this concept out. We're just looking actually into venues for 2018 and beyond. And North America for sure is on our radar in terms of a 3-day event based in one specific location.
So basically, you're going to be headquartered in one place and you'll go out in a different direction each day?
Correct, yeah. Okay. So the concept is three stages rather than seven. We'd probably do a run a Friday, Saturday, Sunday so that people don't have to take too much time off work, and do two stages Friday, Saturday, and then a time trial on the Sunday morning so that you can finish, have lunch, and if you've got to fly from, I don't know, Colorado back to Cleveland, you can make that flight on the Sunday afternoon and be back in work on Monday morning.
Oh, no. You take Monday morning off.
Or you can stay in Colorado for a few days and relax. But yeah, that gives a little bit more opportunity.
Exactly. So the last two things I want to talk about, which is we really can't discuss cost on the show, but people can find that out by looking online. What is included when you sign up for, let's say, the Rockies event that's coming up in June? So what do you get when you sign up?
Obviously get the event as a whole, so you've got the seven stages, and with that comes your neutral support on the bike, your feed stations, the fact that the roads are marshaled in some areas, they're closed, the fact that you have a Colorado State Patrol looking after you as you ride. Plus then everything off the bike that comes with that. So your lunch is provided, then your massage and physiotherapy should you need it post the event. You also get a very nice top-level kit. Again, I can't quite do the dollar conversion, but it's worth a good few $100 in terms of jersey and bib shorts and arm warmers that are provided by Mavic. And I can tell you in Europe, it's probably one of the few events I've seen that's the kit is worn more of a badge of honor that you've done the event. So people say, oh, wow, you've done the goat route. And I haven't found that with too many other events. So you get that. You get all that included. You then have a choice on the accommodation side. So you can book accommodation through us or a tour operator. Some people like to add some additional services. They might come in a small group and want to stay in the same hotel together or have a mechanic or a masseur specific to them. So there's, I don't know, 15-20% of our guys and girls that do that. And then everything outside of that is your own cost. So your dinner is your own cost because people will finish at different times or want to eat in different locations or restaurants. And then flights, obviously, you've got a wide range of people. So we've got, I think, 36 nationalities that are coming over to the Rockies. People are flying from all over the place in and out, so they manage their own flights.
Wow. You already have 36 countries coming to the Rockies outside of the U.S.?
Yep, that's right.
That's
36
awesome.
Includes the US, so US, Canada, Mexico, obviously, and then big contingent from Europe. So Brits are very strong, like to travel a lot. And then you've got, well, simply pretty much any large country that you can think of, from Germany, Spain, Italy, France, Switzerland, and then further afield into the Middle East. So Oman, Dubai, and then places like Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, Thailand. So yeah, it's people are coming pretty much from all over the world. And I think what we'll probably find with these kind of events that when we heavily market a little bit more in America, we'll get Americans coming, or North Americans, should I say, Canadians as well, coming to do the US event, but also then going over to Europe to see what the events are like over there. So that's the aim from our side.
Well, it sounds just wonderful. I don't race a bike. I only ride on the back of a tandem these days, but it really sounds good. Maybe someday you'll come toward the Midwest and take a look. I'm not sure what would be mountainous here. We're pretty flat, but I think it would be a lot of fun to see one of your events. How can people find out more about them?
The website is Oute, so H-O-U-T-E, and then route, you guys would say route, and then .org, O-R-G. So yeah, check that out online and have a look.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. We will post the Oute Roots website on our Facebook page and watch for the Rocky Mavic Oute Root Rockies First Edition coming up in June.
My pleasure. Thanks
All right.
for having me.
Absolutely. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Matt Holden joined me from the UK to talk about Oute Root. It is luxury coupled with tough climbs. If you want to know more about the events, you can log on to oateroot.org and learn all about them. That's our show for this week. I do have two quick notes to add. We are still asking for your 2 to 4 minute why you signed up for the National Bike Challenge audio to be aired throughout the summer. You can use one of the apps available. Voice Record Pro for Apple products seems to offer pretty much what you might need, for example. To record your audio, email it to us at nbcstories2017@gmail.com, and we'll let you know when your story airs. And lastly, Sean Wheaties' 5 lovely girls said goodbye to him last weekend, and while his family and the cycling world still mourn his loss, the GoFundMe campaign for their education is humming along. If you'd like to know more about Sean, his 5 princesses, and the fund, you can go to GoFundMe.com/Whitey Princesses and read the updates. So thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode of The Outspoken Cyclist. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.